This is Ken Chumbly of the University of Louisville Oral History Center. I'm interviewing Sidney Passamanik.
Passamanik,
I'm sorry. As part of our Jewish Oral History Project. The date is October the 12th, 1978. Okay, we're on. Will you begin, Mr. Passamanik, by telling me something about your parents, what you remember about them?
Well, I was born on 9th Street here in Louisville, 1898. I have very little recollection of that particular place. From there, Mom and Dad moved to Jefferson Street between Floyd and Brook. And I recall very vividly living upstairs from Block's liquor store. Across the street was the Haymarket. And right next door there was a stable of some sort. And we lived there till I was I guess 10, 11, 12 years old. As I went to George W. Morris School at that time, I was at Floyd and Chestnut. And Mom and Pop came from what they've told us, what I can remember, both came from Russia, from some town called Kiev. Daddy was a tailor. Mother.
You mentioned that your father was a tailor.
And mother, when she first came to this country, I recall her telling us that she worked for Linker Stobie Company at, I think it's Floyd Madison where they used to be. It's the original Linker Stobie Company. As an immigrant, and there were very few places where they could get jobs. And Madison Street and Preston Street was the core of the Jewish neighborhood at that time. And a Jewish family came over, some other Jewish family helped them. How mother and daddy met, I don't recall. But Dad remained a tailor all his life. And after Mom married, she just was a housewife.
Did they tell you anything about living in Kiev, in Russia? Did they have it tough there?
They had it pretty hard there, yes. Her grandfather, her father, used to tell stories of the pogroms and how they used to hide. And he got out of Russia. Somehow or other, got out of the army, either by buying his way out or getting out somehow or other.
He was in the Tsarist army then.
Yeah. And then when he came over here, later on he brought his family over. That's Mr. Zimmerman. And he came over this country from what my recollection, what they told me, he was a carpenter, very good carpenter. But when he applied for work, found out he had to work on Saturday, on the Sabbath, and being a very religious man, a very orthodox religious man, he would not work on Sabbath. So he started doing, I just don't know how to describe it, a work of his own, of fixing chairs. Just go from house to house, peddling chairs.
His name was Zimmerman, you say?
Yeah.
He was your mother's
father? My mother's father.
And your father's father?
Was Passamanik, Mose Passamanik. He was a tailor.
Okay.
from, I recall vividly playing on the, as a boy with the other Jewish families in the neighborhood. There was a Garden family and a Jacobson family. And Ellie Garden and forget the name of the Jacobson boy. We remained friends all through life.
This was when you were living near the Haymarket.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There were lots of Jews living around there, or?
Yes, because on the next block there was a tenement house operated by a man named Siegel.
Mm-hmm.
And my grandmother lived there, my mother's mother.
Mm-hmm.
So we would visit her quite a lot in that complex. And there was a fish market there, which Mr. Siegel also ran. And it was just about all that the Jewish people at that time could afford, was places like that. And then when you go up the next corner, you've got the Preston Street. And Preston Street from Market to Walnut at first, then it's spread out a little farther, was strictly a Jewish neighborhood. Delicatessen stores, kosher meat markets, kosher dairies.
Was this the Orthodox community?
Strictly Orthodox community.
Mm-hmm. Where were the Reformed people living?
Well, I knew very little about the Reform movement at that time. Later on, as we grew older, we became cognizant of, you know, all I knew at that time was the Reform movement, I mean the Orthodox movement. I wasn't even familiar with the Conservative movement or the Reform movement.
Mm-hmm.
And the Reform movement, most Reform people were out on 2nd Street and 3rd Street. That's where most of them lived. And I recall their first temple was at 6th and Broadway, I think. That's the history of Adith Israel, and then from there they went to 3rd Street. The first Orthodox synagogue that I attended was at Preston and Liberty. There was two Orthodox synagogues. No, there was three in Louisville at that time. The Knesset, no, it wasn't called Knesset, it's called Knesset now. It was Beth HaMedrash HaGadol. It was at Preston and Liberty. That's where my folks attended, and that's where I went with them. And that's where I was bar mitzvah.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was another Orthodox shul on Jefferson Street between Preston and Jackson. Later on, these two organizations merged and became Knesset Israel. And they built a new home on Floyd and Caldwell, I think the street is. The building is still there. From there, they moved over to Taylorsville Road in their modern Orthodox shul, which they have now, which is known now as Knesset Israel. When we were, Daddy worked for a clothing firm at 7th and Main, known as Kentucky Clothing Company. And they were tough times.
About when was this? Would this be 1910, 11?
Let's see. I was born 1898, 9 years old. Be 1908 and 1909
mm-hmm.
in there.
And you say they were tough times.
Yeah, because we lived nicely. Children came along. I was the first of 7.
Mm.
I can recall the first bathtub that we had put in on Jefferson Street. Also, the first mantle, gas mantle.
Mm-hmm.
I had one for many, many years and finally lost it. Welshback gas mantle. We liked the house with gas, these inverted gas mantles.
Hmm.
And from then came the first Edison's electric carbon light.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
From Jefferson Street, we moved to Jackson and Walnut. Daddy bought a home. That was one of the main innermost, desire of the average Jewish person was to own something of his own. They always believed in trying to own your own home.
Mm-hmm.
And when we moved to Jackson and Walnut, there was a drugstore on the corner, Beckman's Drugstore, I remember very well. I then finished up going to school, switched from George W. Morris to Thomas Jefferson School, which was on the same block.
That was in the elementary.
Yeah, elementary school.
We were talking about your going to Thomas Jefferson Elementary, I guess it was.
Oh yeah, Thomas Jefferson Elementary School was on the same block. And in those days, we went to school, we walked to school, and Mama was sure that our ears were clean, and we were neatly dressed. And these are some of the things we miss today. And let me put this in, this just happened to think of this due to some of the problems which teachers are having today with pupils. There was a number of times I came home, and I was complaining that some teacher did this to me or did that to me.
Mm-hmm.
And when I told Mom or Dad about it, I got another whipping. The teacher was right. Now, if my parents ever spoke to the teachers, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
They did. I was never involved in anything like that. But in my day, there was nothing that a teacher could do was wrong.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Our parents, my parents especially, instilled into us that without an education, we won't be anything. That they didn't have an education. My mother couldn't read or write. Daddy went to school for 3-4 grades, I think. And what he learned, he taught himself.
Did they teach us Hebrew?
Yeah. Spoke a lot of Yiddish in the house. And we lived a very close family life. We had a big backyard. And practically every Sunday, especially on Mother's side, her sisters and brothers come over to the house. They would have their pinochle game.
Mm-hmm.
And for recreation, there would be a picnic at Shawnee Park or Iroquois Park, some park.
Mm-hmm.
But we were brought up to respect everyone. We were brought up to not be ashamed that we were Jews, and was strictly at that time Jackson and Walnut was mainly a Catholic neighborhood. On the next block Frank Fears lived. They had the Frank Fear Brewing Company. They had a beautiful home with a great big fountain in the yard.
Hmm.
And they permit us kids to play in there.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd get in fight. I'd get into fights with some of the boys. One boy in particular who's just died recently, Tommy Murnane. And I'd come home. My mom says, "All right," he says, "you fought. Forget it." He says, "You and Tommy will get to know each other real well. You'll be friends the rest of your life." He says, "Just always never be ashamed that you're a Jew. If he calls you a Jew, that's what you are. That's all."
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it worked out that way, that we grew to respect each other and became very, very good friends as life, as time went on.
Mm-hmm.
Tommy just died recently. From when I graduated elementary school, there was only two high schools in Louisville at that time.
Male Emanuel?
Male Emanuel. And you chose the school where most of your friends were going. Mine was at Male.
Mm-hmm.
That was on First Street. I came into Male High School a year Professor Halleck retired, and Professor Tinsley was principal of that school then. And I did right well in school. I was on the honor roll most of the time.
Any particular interest in school?
No.
You became a pharmacist. Yeah. What about the sciences?
I was just taking general subjects.
Mm-hmm.
Just couldn't make up my mind. Frankly, my inclination was for either law or medicine. Mm-hmm. And I find out I didn't have enough money to, when it was getting time to select the college where I was going to go.
Mm-hmm.
Daddy didn't have the money, sent me to medical school, which I wanted. And Mama kept saying, "Go be a pharmacist." This is funny. I use this episode many a time when I was president of the State Association and then making talks to different groups. I use it as a lead-in.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd say, "Mama, why should we live right next door to a drugstore?" I'd say, "Mama, why do you want me to be a druggist?" She says, "Sydney," and she would say it in Yiddish, and I'll translate it. She says, "A druggist, er nimmt a bissel Wasser, and from das macht ihm Geld." A druggist takes some water, and he pours it in a bottle, and he sells it, and he makes money for it. That was the going impression in those days, and it hadn't changed a whole lot today. That you went into a drugstore, you got robbed.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. There used to be a saying, an old German saying, "Teuer als jede Drogerie," which means expensive, same as a drugstore. Until I graduated pharmacy school, got into business for myself, and then Mama saw the difference. It's the old story about this old Jewish woman complaining all the time about her doctor being a robber and charges so much.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden her son became a doctor. The story changed fast.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's human nature.
Tell me a little about the about Male High School, to back up a little. You mentioned as a child getting into some fights with some, I guess, presumably Catholic kids in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, because you were a Jew. Did you have any troubles when you went to Male High School?
No trouble whatsoever. I wasn't eligible, or rather, I wouldn't say eligible, I wasn't wanted in any of the fraternities because there was a strict line drawn in those days between Jews and non-Jews, and as far as the different social clubs were concerned.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't miss them. I was never strong enough to go out for athletics, although I was always interested in athletics, especially football, basketball. But as a boy, to go back some more, all Jewish families in those days made sure that at least their boys, the male of a family, received a Hebrew education. Today, thank goodness, the girls also receive Hebrew education.
What do you mean exactly by Hebrew education?
Going to Hebrew school, mm-hmm. to learn to read Hebrew and to really understand what the Jewish, what a Jew is and what he stands for, and mm-hmm. to know more about your own history, more mm-hmm. about yourself. So after school, we come home from school 1:30, we then would have to go to Hebrew school, which was known as a cheder.
Mm-hmm. How do you spell it? Is that H-E?
C-H-E, oh. Cheder, C-H-E-D-E-R, mm-hmm. cheder. And in those days, there wasn't a Hebrew school run by the community. There were four or five private schools run by individual men. And I went to a man called Rosenthal, which was on Brook Street between Market and Main, right across from Hyman's Junk Shop. And his little school was in the back of his house. And there we were taught Hebrew. And we'd go 5 days a week. And when I was getting closer to my 13th year, my parents changed me over to a Mr. Friedman, who had a cheder, or Hebrew school, on Jefferson Street near Preston. And he got me ready for my bar mitzvah.
One person whom I interviewed about the Hebrew school said that that he recalled his tutor or teacher to be very strict, almost not so much brutal, but very strict.
Very strict, very strict. Mr. Rosenthal, God bless him, he'd have a ruler. And he didn't mind hitting you over the hand with that ruler if you wasn't behaving yourself. Mm-hmm. And we had some pretty bad boys in those days. Mm-hmm. We had some tough kids. And there were just as many bad boys then as there is today. And there were gangs and everything else. But as you think back, most of them all, it turned out real good. Most of the boys turned out all right. Mm-hmm.
How long did the Hebrew school last in terms of years? Was it a...
Usually your parents would start you when you're 8, 9 years old, and you'd go through your 13th year. Hopefully they would want you to go more, but the average boy, he felt, oh, that's enough, see. And he was wrong, I was wrong too. Then along came the Talmud Torah, which was built by the different synagogues, which was a Hebrew school. Today, you have, they're still in existence over at the center. Mm-hmm. Along with that, we also have, today we have the Jewish Day School, which is a recognized school. I think they go through the 7th or 8th grade now, I don't know. And the boys and girls are taught a much better Hebrew education than we got. We were taught, the rote way. We were taught to read, but we weren't taught sufficiently to know exactly what we were reading in Hebrew. We were taught to read Hebrew, but we weren't taught enough translation of Hebrew. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Which some of us have picked up since. Today the boys and girls are taught taught conversational Hebrew, like you have in Israel today. You speak Hebrew.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We didn't hear this. The language was Yiddish, which is almost a lost language now.
Mm-hmm.
I think they've got a course at the school now in Yiddish.
In Yiddish?
Mm-hmm. They have in some colleges. I don't know if U of L has one.
Well, I know there's one in Hebrew, modern Hebrew.
Modern Hebrew.
But not, I don't think there's not anything in Yiddish. It'd be difficult to, well, it might not be so difficult to find somebody to teach that, since you probably remember most of it anyway.
Oh, yeah. I can't read like I used to. I used to be able to read and write Yiddish very, very fluently.
Mm-hmm.
Still speak, but when you don't use something over the years, it gets away from you.
Yeah, it really does. So your parents were determined that you would know your heritage, really.
Right.
And so I guess they emphasized.
They emphasized the need of never forgetting that you're a Jew, see, and to live a Jewish life.
Mm-hmm.
We were also taught charity. I like to emphasize this because it has been a big part of my life. I can recall Mama's Kitchen on the door sill. There was five or six little boxes, which was known as pushkis, charity boxes.
Hmm.
Pushki is the Jewish word for charity boxes, and they were for different, I don't recall the organizations. And every Friday evening before Mama lit her candles, each child was given a penny or two pennies to put in that pushki. We were taught, regardless of what we had, how little we had,
mm-hmm.
some had to go to charity.
Mm-hmm.
And that has, I think, this has stayed with the Jewish religion all through life. We just finished Yom Kippur. We say that charity and penitence will help God forgive us our sins. That you've got to forgive your own sins. You've got to forgive the sins you've made to others yourself. Nobody can forgive. If I've done some harm to you, nobody in the world can redress that harm or change it except me.
Mm-hmm.
That's the Jewish religion. You can't ask God to forgive me because I did something to you. See, I gotta have you forgive me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then I went to College of Pharmacy.
And you said that was across from the medical school.
Yeah, it was right across from the medical school, Louisville College of Pharmacy. And it was just a 2-year course then. And in order to get through school, I had no job at the drugstore at 7th and Walnut Street, model drugstore. Dr. Edelson owned it. I'd go down there 7 o'clock in the morning and open up, clean up, and then get to school by 9 o'clock. After school, get back. But while in high school, cutting back, each of us had to find a way of earning our own way. So I never had a newspaper route, but I had a magazine route. A Saturday Evening Post, Ladies' Home Journal, and Country Gentleman. You used to get that from the old Eiler Goodman store, which used to be on 4th Street, right next door to the drugstores on that corner. I think it was Bushmeyer's drugstore, and they were on next door. And I made sufficient money for my spending money by selling these magazines. And also a Saturday job working as a shoe salesman at the old Dan Cohn shoe store on 4th Street in the children's department. I was a pretty good salesman too.
You were pretty busy, it sounds like.
Had to be busy. Because Daddy said, once you get all the education you can, but you've got to help yourself as much as you can.
Mm-hmm.
He had 7 kids, and when he left Kentucky Clothing Company, he went to M. Cohn & Sons, which was a tailoring concern that made their own clothes and sold their own clothes. Their shop was on the second floor, Third and Market.
Mm-hmm.
And he was with them many years until the unions came in and unified it and called a strike. And Daddy was considered, he was forming the shop, he was considered part of management. And when the strike was settled, part of the settlement was that they had to let my daddy go and rehire him. So he then went into a little tailoring store of his own. And got a place out at Camp Knox during the World War I. Oh, by the way, while in high school, no, it was high school, the Student Army Training Corps was formed during World War I, and I joined that. When I came home and told Mama what I had done, that I joined the Army, as I called it, which it wasn't, she looked at me, and it's still funny to me. She says, "Sidney, God help this country. They need guys like you."
Oh, no.
I was a little thin, scrawny guy.
Huh. Oh, man. That was during the First World War, you say?
Yeah. Towards the end of it, yes. Mm-hmm. And I never even really, didn't even receive a uniform. The war ended. Got a discharge. Jackson and Walnut. In those days, we stayed home. We didn't go out looking for an apartment as soon as you got to be 17, 18, 19 years old. You were brought up with your family and you remained with your family. And around that time, a group of boys. Most of our time then was spent at the YMHA. It was on 2nd Street. No, it first started on 1st Street, right across the Male High School was the first YMHA. They moved to their new building on 2nd Street. And I became very active in different types of clubs and things of that sort, the HA. One of them was a junior literary society. We've had our debating teams. By the way, I was on the, we had our debating teams, and we'd have our, four or five boys talk for prizes.
Oratory?
Oratory contest.
Yeah.
The word got away from me. And I was in several oratory contests at the Male High. Never could win because Hugo Tostein, who is now Judge Tostein, he would always top everyone. I recall in high school going back several incidents. Professor Moore was our English teacher, Professor Bradbury, who also taught English. Mr. Snively, who taught algebra. Mr. Hatfield, history. I recall something that has stayed with me through years, and I think it taught me something very good. in Mr. Professor Moore's class, we had to bring a composition, a daily composition. And one day I came and I didn't have it. And he says, "What's the matter with you? Where's your composition?" I says, "Professor Moore," I says, "I just didn't have an inspiration to write." He says, "Let me tell you something." He says, "Work is 99%, not inspiration, perspiration, 99% perspiration and 1% inspiration. Don't you ever be late again." And that taught me something all through life. If you want anything, you got to work for it.
The teachers were pretty demanding at Mayo?
Yes. Because that was a college preparatory school, with any college from there. Dr. Maxwell taught languages.
Mm-hmm.
Pappy Glenn had just died recently, 100 and some odd years old, in the paper the other day. He taught there, taught Greek, I think. Oh, they had, it was a real school. And Mr. Duffy was our football coach, and he could rant before Thanksgiving Day to beat Manuel. And we beat him.
Were there many Jews going to school there?
Yes, we had quite a nice enrollment of Jewish boys. And they had some pretty good Jewish athletes, too, in those days. There was Earl Gradfelder, who was a sprint man, 100-yard dash man. There was Florsheim, who played football, like we call. Quite a number of boys are very good in athletics.
Did the teachers accept you? Did they didn't, of course, make light of you or
No.
Anything like that in class?
No. You were just another student in that class.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And as a whole, the other students, there was very little, what you call it, anti-Semitism that was shown. Mm-hmm. The only time that you felt it was when you knew that you weren't eligible to any of the society organizations, Athenaeum, I don't know what. And also, this happened to me in College of Pharmacy. Get back a few minutes. About 3-4 days after final exams, I got a telephone call from Dr. Dilly, dean of the school. Would I come over to see him? He said, "Oh, I must have failed." I said, "I couldn't, because I was standing pretty high in class."
Mm-hmm.
I was an honor man in the first year. Turned out I was second honor my last year, senior year. It's only 2 years. So, well, I says, "What's wrong? Did I fail?" He says, "Oh, no. He says, "We got a problem." I says, "What's the problem?" He says, "You know, normally, first and second honor men make the, with the two speeches, the first honor man, one's a back, they call the two speeches you make this
valedictorian
and the salutatorian. Yeah. You see, when you get to 80 years old, you don't remember too much. So he says, "Normally, you would make the valedictorian address." He says, "But the class had a meeting, and they decided they wanted one of their boys from their fraternity to make the." I said, "That's all right with me. I don't care. I have no desire to publicist or anything." He says, "But the man they chose flunked and he's not going to graduate." He says, "And I want you to do it." I says, "Wait a minute, let's back up here a little bit. They don't want me. Why would you want me?" He says, "Because they don't want you." He says, "I think they're wrong." He says, "I've never liked it."
Mm-hmm.
And he says, as a personal favor to me, will you do that? Well, it so happened one of my closest friends in my class there got drowned, and I would like to have paid him a compliment that night. So I said, yes, I'll be glad to. So our graduating class in those days was very small. I think it was 14 in our class. And we used the YMCA auditorium at 3rd and Broadway. That was the first breakdown between the so-called social organizations and a Jewish boy. But these are things that you live with in life, and they don't cause a lot of damage.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think everybody has an absolute perfect right to feel the way they want to feel and do what they want to do, as long as they don't stop somebody else from doing what they want to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What were the courses like that you took at the College of Pharmacy?
College of Pharmacy, we had pharmacology, chemistry, biology, chemical arithmetic, the USP. In fact, I couldn't afford to buy most of the books. I used a lot of notebooks and took a lot of notes.
Mm-hmm.
And something else that one of the professors, professor in chemistry, Dr. Curry, had a good way of putting what an education is and what it means. He says, education is knowing where to find something when you have to. Says your mind is trained to know where to go.
Mm-hmm.
And on an oral examination, he asked me a question. And I threw that at him. Dr. Curry, I know just where I can get this for you in about 2 seconds. I know almost what page it's on, but I don't know the answer right now. He says, won't help you at all right now. But he gave me a passing grade.
Yeah. You were graduated then, and then did you find a job easily, or did you have some difficulties?
Let's see, I found, right after I graduated, is when I went into the Students Army Training Corps, right, mm-hmm. from college. Spent 3-4 months there. Then when the war ended, I had been working for Dr. Edelson.
Mm-hmm. At the model drug.
Model drug stores of the school. Then when the war ended, I got a job with the drugstore on the corner of Baxter and Broadway, Mr. Young. I was there about 6-7 months. Oh, wait a minute. No, but let's back up here. After school, right after the school, my first job was with Newman Drug Company. Forgotten almost about that. In those days, Newman Drug Company was the top pharmacy in the city of Louisville. The downstairs was the commercial part, and on the second floor was the pharmacy.
Mm-hmm.
They had 5 pharmacists up there. Mm. And year in and year out, Mr. Goodman, who was in charge, would employ the top student from the College of Pharmacy if he could get him.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had 2 offers. One to go with T.P. Taylor. It was Taylor Isaacs at that time, 4th and Broadway, they had a store. Or to go with Newman. And when I looked into what I was going to do, found out I would be doing nothing but ethical pharmacy, filling prescriptions only at Newman's, that's where I went, because that's what I wanted to round out my education. I needed the practical experience.
Mm-hmm.
So I told Mr. Isaacs at that time, I said, I can sell. I said, what I want is some more experience in filling prescriptions. So I went with Newman's and stayed with them for a while. The war broke out, then I went with the SATC.
What's that?
The Student Army Training Corps.
Oh.
That's when I went to them.
Okay.
When that was over, well, I recall something else, just humorous things. I don't know if it's worthwhile or not. But on Sundays, at the Newman Drugstore, only one man worked in the prescription department. And my first Sunday alone, these prescriptions were coming up in trays up at the dumbwaiter. I'd fill up one and I'd fall on my hands and I'd pray. I wasn't getting anything done at all. I was getting so nervous, it was pitiful. And Pop Wendell, who was on duty downstairs, came upstairs to see what was the matter. Nothing was coming down. And thank God he immediately saw what was going on. And instead of jumping me and saying, what the hell is this all about? He put his arms around me and says, Sid, look, take this easy. Just fill one prescription. Don't look at the next one. Check it, send it downstairs, and then pick the next one up. He says, you'll be all right. He walked away. Because if he had said anything else to me, I probably would have put my hand in court on my home. And that taught me something, too. That taught me how to take care of people. And I think it had a lot to do with the years I was in business. I never had to fire anybody.
Mm-hmm.
I had people stay with me for years and years and years. The store we just closed up, Eastern Parkway. I had four soda fountain girls with me from the day I closed the day I opened. You learn all these things from experience if you really want to learn. Now we're getting to the point where we go back to the YMHA when we got over on 2nd Street. A group of us boys formed a club called the there's a boys club of 10 men, see, 10, 11 of us. And we give dances and fairs. And after 2 or 3 years, we start getting married. I met my wife, she lived on Madison Street. Her name was Krebs, Anna Krebs. She worked for an insurance company. And I was in business already with Leonard Stern. Oh, to go back again a little bit, back up. Living upstairs from us on Wallace Street in Daddy's home is a family named Stern. And Leonard had also graduated from pharmacy school the year before I did. And he was in the Army. He was in the main Army. Sedalis Club's the name of our club. Sedalis. So Leonard, myself, found out that the little model drugstore was for sale. Dr. Edelson, who owned the store, was still over in Europe in the Army. And Mr. Sauter had power of attorney. He wanted to sell the store. So Daddy loaned us $1,000. We had about $500 between us, our money we got from the government. Our bonus, $60 bonus, whatever else we had saved up, and Daddy loaned us $1,000. And we bought that little drugstore. The drugstore wasn't any bigger than his kitchen. The heater with a pot belly stove. It was at 7th and Walnut. We, first year, who were in Venice towards the end of that year, Leonard got married, and 6 months later, I got married. We then moved that little small store to the corner where Bockhorst used to have a saloon. There's three saloons on three corners. There was an article in the paper the other day about Walnut Street.
Old Walnut Street?
Yeah. The fella had the name Bockhorst spelled wrong.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He had Barhorst. And he talked about some sandwich or something, but it wasn't any sandwiches. He made his money on a bowl of beans for a nickel and a pig's feet for a nickel. Glass of beer for a nickel and eat all the hard-boiled eggs and ham you wanted free.
Mm.
That's what you could do in those days.
Mm.
So right after we were married, well, before I was married, I was right after we were married. We were married from Walnut Street. Mom, because we lived with her mother for a month or two on Madison Street. Then Daddy bought a home on 2nd Street. The migration started from the Reform people moving from 2nd Street to 3rd Street up to the Highlands. And the Orthodox people began moving to 2nd Street and 3rd Street and then through there.
Mm-hmm.
From Preston Street and in that neighborhood. They were stepping up a little in our economic structure.
Mm-hmm.
So they moved to 2nd and Hill. There was a third floor apartment which Hannah and myself took. And we lived with our parents for about a year on that third floor. I think Leonard and myself were the first of the Orthodox boys to go into drug business in Louisville. There was another Jewish druggist, he was reformed, it was Mr. Abrams, I think his name was, at First and Broadway. And another man named Poznanski was somewhere in the West End, I forget just where he was. But I was very aggressive when we opened up several stores. And when I'd get home, Mama would say, Sidney's Mrs. Goldstein and Mrs. So-and-so, Miss Barron. Her son is studying pharmacy. Can you find a job for him? It's almost impossible for a Jewish boy to get a job then in any of those stores. So most of them worked for us for a while. They all did all right. We had had a store at 7th and Walnut, 5th and Jefferson, 4th and Liberty, Roseboro Road. My brothers came along. They studied pharmacy. And then my wife's sister, her husband studied pharmacy. They all worked for us. I guess the truth was known. Leonard and myself made a little too much money that first year. And we stepped up our way of living a little too fast. And I guess other people said, gee, this must be pretty good. We better get into it too. We worked awful hard on that corner. That was in the days when 7th Street was known as the red light district of Louisville. Mm-hmm. And that whole territory from 6th to 8th, Liberty to Chestnut, was full of prostitutes. And from the day we opened up, we said that these people, when they walk into our store, walk through that door, they were the best people on earth.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way we treated them. We never lost a dime on them. But I used to close it. In those days, we'd open at 7 o'clock in the morning and close at midnight.
And long hours.
Yeah, you'd have to walk. I'd have to walk down 7th Street to get a streetcar. There was no bus or anything. A streetcar, run a trolley car on Jefferson Street. And quite often, when the girls would accost me and stop me, she'd recognize me and she'd apologize. I don't know whether or not, whether we weren't better off conditions the way they were then or better than we are today.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't know. Mm-hmm. You're never going to stop prostitution, whether in a controlled area like it was, where people knew what it was all about.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that was better than what we have today, I don't know. We got massage parlors and God knows what, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Evidently your businesses thrived. You had 4 or 5
mm-hmm.
stores?
And we were 5th and Jefferson when had a real nice business there. Also had a store at 5th and 7th and Walnut, and store on Bronzeville Road, and store 11th and Walnut. Most of the family were working for us. Our lease was expiring at 5th and Jefferson. Matt O'Doherty owned the building. And he wouldn't give us a new lease. And that's when they were putting up the building here at Eastern Parkway. That's 1928, I think it was. And we went out there and talked to them, the builders, and was able to get a lease on that building. Matt O'Doherty wouldn't renew our lease. He would give us a year-to-year lease. He was of the opinion that the National Bank of Kentucky were going to move him where they were on Main Street to his corner. He was on their board of directors.
Mm-hmm.
And he was holding it for that. So.
Mm-hmm. Did they finally move there?
Oh, they finally went. The following year, after we'd opened up at Eastern Parkway, we closed up there, so I wouldn't take a year's lease. Depression hit,
mm-hmm.
and they went broke. That's when the bank failure starts
mm-hmm.
came in. They went bad. They really went to pieces.
What did that do to your businesses?
Well, we opened up at Eastern Parkway just about that time. And we realized that we got rid of 7th and Waller, we sold that. We sold everything else. And we just had the one store, two of us going to one store. And we realized that things may not be too good. Well, that's something else. I was told, don't you dare go in that neighborhood. That's a Catholic neighborhood, and you're not going to make good. I says, I don't see any reason why if I go out there and be nice to people, people won't be nice to me.
Mm-hmm.
If I take care of them, they're going to take care of me. It's just that simple. And that's the way it worked out, 48 years of it. So, right after... Oh, we were there a year, and the Depression hit the following year, and things got bad. We didn't know whether it'd be enough for the two of us or not. And we sat down and talked it over, and I says, Doc, that's what I called him. Doc, let's do something. We don't know what the end of the year, what this is going to be, whether it's going to be enough for both of us or not. He had a child then, mm-hmm. I didn't. So we sat down and wrote up an agreement that if at the end of the year there wasn't sufficient business for the two of us, sufficient income for the two of us, that one would buy the other out. And we agreed to the price at that time. So there'd be no question, no arguments. We want to remain friends.
Mm-hmm.
Well, at the end of the year, there wasn't enough for both of us. And I said to him, I said, Doc, you got a baby, you got a family. You buy me out. Because he had just inherited a little money.
Mm-hmm.
I never had a dime. I just got married. He says, Cindy, I don't want this darn business here. He says, I don't like it. He says, yeah, to bow to these people. And by that time, a lot of Jewish people had moved into the neighborhood of the Reform element city.
Mm-hmm.
And we were getting a lot of their business too. And he says, you buy me out. I said, well, I don't have any money, Leonard. You know it. He said, oh, you can get it. So I had to go out and dig. I went to the Liberty Bank, where we're dealing with, and Johnny Hume, who was then president, but on his way out because they were having problems too. And they brought in a young man, Merle Robertson, from Chicago, and he'd been over at the Security Bank for a while, being trained. And he was brought in to replace Johnny Hume by the stockholders. And Johnny says, I need a $10,000, which was no day that was a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
He says, Sid, he says, you know I'm on my way out. In those days, there was only one bank, no branches or nothing. You went to the main bank.
Mm-hmm.
And you walked in, the officers were sitting up front, the president's door was on the other side. It opened up, you walk in and say, hi, Johnny. Hi, Mr. Passamani.
Mm-hmm.
He says, Sid, he says, be no problem. He said, well, let me call. He says, you know, I'm on the way out, and I can't recommend or do anything. My hands are tied. He says, let me call Mr. Robertson. Then. So he called him down. He's a young fellow, first time I've met him. I looked at him. He looked at me. He says, well, what kind of collateral do you have? I said, wait a minute, let's start from new. Now, do you mind if I call you Merle? My name's Sidney. We're both about the same age.
Mm-hmm.
I said, if I had the clarity you wanted, I wouldn't need you. I said, now let me tell you something else. All the loans that Johnny Hume made to boys like myself, the banks never lost a nickel or dime on it. Because we go out and we work, we sweat, and we pay off. I says, the bank is in trouble on the big loans that the board of directors made. Kentucky Wagon Works, which happened to be one at that time, which I named.
Mm-hmm.
I'm mentioning names because it's true. And other big outfits. I said, the board of directors put this bank in trouble, not Johnny Hume.
Mm-hmm.
I says, forget it. I says, I'll get it. I says, there's other ways I can get some money. And he looked at me. He says, your little so-and-so is just saying your name.
Hmm.
He made the loan to me. We remained the closest of friends all through life.
Hmm.
He's still a personal friend of mine. He dealt in no other store except mine. His family still lives on Spring Drive. And I need a little extra. You know, a man named Kling Stationery Company, and George Gould from Gould & Company. They let me have some money, credit. And no problem. I've been for myself.
Mm-hmm.
After a couple of years, I again wanted to branch out and open a store on Bronsburn Road. Mr. Cole was building a store there for Stidens. And I knew Mr. Cole. I said, how about building a store next door there for me for a drugstore? It's a good idea. So we put a store in there. My brother-in-law put him in that store. It's Urban Krebs, it's my wife's brother. And I missed something that's very, very important. We had a store at the Preston and Atwood too at that time, where my brother, he ran that store for a while. And I brought him in to Eastern Parkway. I'll get to that in a few minutes. Then we've opened up a store at 3rd and...
Okay.
So when...
We ran those stores for quite a while, and then the war came up. Things were getting hard for help and everything. And I turned the Brownsboro Road store over to my brother-in-law, and the one on 3rd and Central I turned over to my brother.
Mm-hmm.
On a financial arrangement where they paid me out so much a month for whatever time it took. And I didn't want to make it a gift because I don't think there's an appreciation when you give somebody something. But it was in the form of a gift, I mean, where they was given part interest immediately and then pay the balance out.
Mm-hmm.
And I just took care of the one store. And
this was where again? The store that you...
Yeah, at Bardstown, Old Eastern Parkway. Yeah. It was in 1930-31 at that time. When did World War II break out? 32?
No, much later.
No, it was in the 40s.
41,
yeah. So it was in 41 when I got rid of the stores, yeah. Because that's when I was president of the B'nai B'rith Lodge at that time. And we had no problem to increase our membership. I'm just rambling.
Go ahead.
From around 300 to over 700, and I was when I was asked, Sid, what did you do? The other boys didn't do that. Increase the membership so great. I said, I didn't do nothing. I says, Hitler's got a knife at our throats, and they're hollering, help me.
Mm-hmm.
The Anti-Defamation League is what they're turning to. I says, it's a simple matter of self-preservation. Now they're all joining.
Mm-hmm.
They'll drop out after a while, which some of them did.
Mm-hmm.
It's the history of all organizations. You come running when you want help. And
were you involved in other organizations at the time?
At that time, well, I was involved with the United Jewish Campaign, always, mm-hmm. as a fundraiser. And beginning to get involved in pharmacy circles. I organized a group here in Louisville. I got to organize a Louisville Retail Druggist Association.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was in 1928. Pretty good looking guy then. Trying to save, I realized way back then that the independent drugstores were in trouble. They didn't get together. And organize and fight back. We organized this buying and advertising organization, and it worked pretty good for a while until somebody, the word got back to me that people wanted to know what I was making out of it, whereas I was giving my time and my own money to make the thing go.
Mm-hmm.
Sacrificing my time and everything. And when I heard that, I just quit. When I quit, the thing folded.
Hmm.
That's an old. Bill Fisher was in. This was right there.
Mm-hmm, I read that.
And then I was. There was always a feeling. There were a number of Jewish drugstores in Louisville at that time. There's always a feeling that a Jewish boy couldn't get anywhere with the state association. There's no way of him becoming president or being part of the top echelon. I says, oh, you guys are crazy. If you get in and work and show that you want to do something, you'll be accepted and you'll go up.
Mm-hmm.
So I became active in the Kentucky Pharmaceutical Association. And the result of that, and 1950-51, I became its president.
Mm-hmm.
that was taken at one of the meetings. I was on the board of directors and chairman of the board and president of the association.
You're still, are you still active in these various associations?
No, I'm still active in the Louisville Hebrew Home.
Uh-huh. Four Courts?
That's Four Courts, yes.
What do you do for them?
I'm on the board there, and I'm chairman of the utilization committee, which I've been begging them to relieve you of, but they won't do it.
They won't?
No.
I know you're
a good
worker, I guess.
Well, no. After I didn't sell the store at Eastern Park. There's two stores I'd like to get into this. I think that somewhere along the line somebody might be interested in it. In the old days when we lived on Jefferson Street and Walnut Street, there was two drug stores that most of the Jewish people in that neighborhood went to. They were their doctors. One of them was called Rectanus at Preston and Market. There was two drugs. One name I remember was Dietrich. I don't remember the other boy's name. And on the corner of Preston and Walnut, there was a drugstore called Vanderep's.
Mm-hmm.
And if there was anything wrong in a family, they went to the drugstore, and he gave them some medicine, fixed them up, and they got well. Who had money to call a doctor? I recall in those days, Dr. Barber, who had delivered several of mother's children, would come to the house in his horse and buggy, and I'd ride around with him. He's the first pediatrician in Louisville. He went to Germany, became a pediatrician, studied pediatrics.
Mm-hmm.
One of the first. Wonderful man. And, I got active in, all social work in Louisville. I was active in YMHA, and I never wanted any offices or anything like that. I just, So when I got active in the Kentucky Pharmaceutical Association, it wasn't any time, because I was never a yes man. I'm in a crowd, they're going to know I'm there. And first thing you know, I was on the board, chairman of the board, and became president. Just the other day I received a letter wondering if I'd come to a meeting next Wednesday in Frankfurt. They're trying to get all the past presidents together to get them interested again.
Uh-huh.
So I've dug up this report I made when I came back from California on my first trip out there to the NARD when I was president of the association, which was in 1956. I want to call people's attention that the things they're talking and fighting about today, the same things we were talking and fighting about in 1956. We haven't gotten anywhere yet. And
tell me a little about World War II and what stands out in your mind about that period.
World War II, you all must have
had some indications of what was happening in Germany.
You had indications of it, but you never had any proof.
Mm-hmm.
I recall listening to a speaker, I've forgotten his name now, he had a patch over one eye, he was a columnist, talking to a group here in Louisville, Jewish people. He warned us what was happening over there. He says that some of the rich Jewish people over there are going to be sadly disappointed. They didn't think Hitler was going to do things to them, because they were helping Hitler out with money and everything.
Mm-hmm.
He says they'll find out that eventually they're going to be just like everybody else. And that's how it came about. Now, my recollection of mostly of World War II was the work that Mrs. Pasternak and her group, well, we had groups going out to Knox all the time, and soldier dinners and dances and everything there, all of those things. Louisville, I think Louisville took care of the soldiers better than any other city in the United States that was close to camp. And the wife was chairman of a group, Ladies Benevolent Society, it's out of business now.
Was that a Jewish group?
Jewish group of women who took parties every, once a month they went out there, or twice a month, take ice cream and cake and stuff and call on the hospitals, sit down and write notes for people, you know, do everything they could. Mm-hmm. They weren't the only group doing it. They continued it. And Christmas came and things like that, three or four of us would go out with them to help. We got caught out there one Christmas Eve, day before Christmas, you know. It stormed terrible. There's snow and sleet. They wouldn't let us come home. They put us up. It was Harry Resnick and myself are the only men out there with him. Harry's dead now. And they prepared breakfast for us the next morning. And who waits on us but some German prisoners of war was brought over here. To me, that was the most, I don't know the proper word for it, but it just was laughable. But they were just as nice. And I've always said, we could take the generals and all the top leaders and put them on a front line, we wouldn't have a war. We wouldn't have a war very long. The people do not want to fight.
Mm-hmm.
People may turn off the shooting system.
It is a little chilly.
People get along together.
Mm-hmm.
I think the problem we're having now in the Near East is economics. You take the oil situation out of it and be no problem. People get along.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you to, for a moment, to reflect on how you've seen the Jewish community locally change during your lifetime.
Well, I've seen it becoming more cohesive.
I've heard a lot of people say that.
Yes. Yeah. For example, when I got married, I went from the Orthodox to the conservative movement because I did not like the arrangement. In the Orthodox, men and women do not sit together.
Mm-hmm.
In the conservative, they did, see. I wanted to be with my wife. And I was very fond of Rabbi Gilliman over there at that time. Rabbi Zarki married us, an Orthodox rabbi.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a very humorous incident on that, too. We were married on Madison Street. And my mother-in-law's home, a small little one-floor apartment, all squeezed together, all the friends and everything. And we were under the canopy, a chuppah, it's called. And this rabbi, my mother, that morning, Mom had asked me to show her my wedding band. I showed it to her, and it was engraved.
Mm-hmm.
She said, Sidney says, Rabbi won't use this. It's not allowed to have an engraved ring, which I didn't know. And she gave me, she said, here, use my ring if you need it. Had in the pocket. So under the canopy, when the part came where you could put the ring on the bride's finger, he looked at it. I saw him look, then I saw him go right on through with the ceremony. Didn't stop. Well, he was a wonderful teacher and a wonderful old man. A few weeks later, he happened to be in my drugstore, 7th and Walnut. And I said, Rabbi, I said, you gave me a scare. And he said, what's that? And I told him the incident, what Mama told me and all that sort of stuff. He said, well, Sidney, he says, if you had come to me before and showed me the ring, I would have had to tell you I couldn't use it. He says, but under the chuppah, mitarnit farshtern echasni. We dare not disturb a wedding. A wedding is the most holy thing.
Huh.
And you don't do anything to interfere with the marriage ceremony.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now there is a broad-minded man, see. When the feeling was very, very tense, not tense, but just not too good between Orthodox Judaism and Reform Judaism and Conservative Judaism, Rabbi Zarki never failed to be willing to sit on a forum with any of them.
Mm-hmm.
He says, they're Jews, same as we are.
Mm-hmm.
And we joined as Jeshurun, wife myself. And so did Max Wallman and Yetta. That's why I got to go over to her house in a few minutes to pick my wife up. And I remember my daddy saying to me, huh, I'm going to be a goy now. I'm going to be a Christian now. Well, it took a few months for him to come over and sit in the service. And he saw there wasn't any difference. We had a little more English in the service, which they have now.
Mm-hmm.
We sat together, yes. But there was so little difference. And he finally said, I'm wrong. So just little by little, and intermarriage mainly,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Through intermarriage, there's very little cleavage now between Orthodox, Reform. I think there's a wonderful working arrangement between all of them. Everybody pulling for the same thing,
mm-hmm.
For a strong Judaism.
You think that's what lies before Judaism then? Cohesiveness, trying to create a strong
certainly
community?
That's right. Yeah.
Do you think a lot of that grew out of the experiences with the Holocaust and all?
No question.
Yeah.
No question.
Mm-hmm.
Even, see, the Reform movement for a while went so far that they would not allow any Hebrew taught in their Hebrew schools even.
Is that right?
Some of them, yeah.
Yeah.
But that has all swung back now.
Now they're sort of rediscovering one's
yeah,
past.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It all swung back.
Do you have any last remarks? I know you need to.
I know Dr. Rauch, who was a very, very anti-Zionist.
Yeah, I've heard that.
And a very dear personal friend of mine. He wouldn't let anybody take care of him but me. The day that Israel became a state,
mm-hmm.
He said there's no such thing as being an anti-Zionist anymore. He said there is a state of Israel, and we have to support it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is the theme that has gone all through it. I don't know whether what I've said about... in the old days, there were people like Mr. Flegel, who had a bakery at Floyd and Market. He called Flegel the Baker. And there were the butcher stores, and he called Weinberg the Butcher.
Mm-hmm.
They were all called by their names. Or Weinberg, the milkman, it was.
Mm-hmm.
Kramer was a butcher, Kramer the Butcher. There was three or four Orthodox butcher shops in Louisville then. Today, I think we have one.
Yeah. You've come a long way from Jefferson Street or the Haymarket to Plainview.
Yeah.
Haven't you?
Yeah. I don't think I've come a long way. I'm the same old Sidney Passmack I was then.
You are?
I don't see any difference.
Yeah.
You go through life making friends. We had our 50th anniversary 8 years ago. Our kids gave it to us, our nieces and nephews, at the temple. And I know there's no invitations or anything, just an announcement. And I know it was over 800 people came there to wish us well.
Mm-hmm.
I closed a drugstore. I didn't sell the store. Eastern Parkway. I got held up twice that year.
Mm.
And I says, there's no sense of fooling with this. I just went up and locked the door and auctioned it off.
Is that right?
Yeah.
When was that again?
It was 4 years ago, 1974.
Now that there's some sort of furniture store where your drugstore
yeah,
once was?
There's a, for a decorating store.
Interior
decorating store.
Yeah.
Interior decorating stores there. I leased it to him. I had two and a half years ago on my lease yet. And I leased it to him. I'm off of it now. But I was just scared stiff that so next time they'd pull up. Then 2 weeks after that, my wife had a stroke. So my job has been since then, taking care of her.
I want to thank you for your time.
Don't know how much good it is or what it means or anything. I hope maybe 100 years from now somebody will find something there.
I want to thank you.